BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
I spent the commercial break texting all the high school basketball coaches that I know who would benefit from hearing a little bit of my conversation with Peter Newell Jr. Pete Newell Jr. Now, for those of you who know basketball, Pete Newell Sr. coached Cal. Yes, that Cal. To the NCAA championship in 1959. Made the Final Four in back-to-back years. Legendary coach who obviously was rivals with John Wooden. And people know that the Pete Newell-John Wooden rivalry, it got fierce. Now, Newell went on to coach the United States Olympic basketball team to a gold medal in the 1960 Olympics in Rome. That 1960 Olympic team had Oscar Robertson, Jerry West, Jerry Lucas, and Pete Newell Sr.'s win in the Olympics made him one of only three coaches to win the Triple Crown. Won the NIT tournament when it was worth a damn, won the NCAA National Championship, won an Olympic championship. I got a text early in the show as I was promoting the interview from a high school basketball coach in the state of Oregon who said, hey, I'm running Pete Newell's reverse action offense. We're running a variation of the offense still to this day. His fingerprints are all over college basketball and the NBA. He also, Pete Newell Sr., consulted with the NBA later in his basketball coaching career and talked with him about the shot clock and how to improve the game. His son, Pete Newell Jr., who you're going to hear from here in a minute, I crossed paths with him like 25, 27 years ago when he was the boys varsity basketball coach at Santa Cruz High School. It's a position he held for like 30 years. And obviously, he's got the pedigree with a dad who coached at the level that his father coached at. But he also grew up in a household where basketball wasn't the only thing going on. His mom was an influential figure in that family and really became kind of a mother figure to Bobby Knight, who I coached, or I went on to cover later in my career. And that Newell-Knight relationship is fascinating. And, you know, Pete Jr. obviously went on to win a state championship in high school. I think he was 61 when he won that state championship. His final season coaching at Santa Cruz High School, 30th year on the job, got the school finally a state basketball championship in boys basketball. So he's joining us now. And he was kind of a thorn in my side when I covered him. I told the story earlier in the show about, you know, the first time I ever called up and I said, hey, coach, I'm writing a preview about your team. I was brand new to Santa Cruz. Who do you have coming back? He said, that's your job, and he hung up on me. And he was right. It was lazy of me. Pete Newell Jr. joining us now. How you doing?
Fine, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. Do you remember hanging up on me, or you probably did that to a number of people?
No, you're one of the few. It is true, and if I have a moment, that season, your get back to me on the hang-up was we had an annual early December tournament that we hosted called the Dad's Tournament. It was 18 three days, and you covered it on Saturday. We were playing for third place on Saturday, and two out-of-town teams were playing, Salinas and Paso Robles, for the championship. This is probably December of 95, and we're playing SoCal, had a good first half, and then early in the third quarter, we had a baseline out of bounds, and we didn't execute it, and our point guard, who was our best player, got upset at his teammates, and I just didn't like the vibe going through, so I substituted all five of them. And by the time they came back to the game, the beginning of the fourth quarter, we were down. But the point was is that one of the kids told me that this kid, the point guard, did not want to go back in the game. So I went down to him and I told him this between quarters. I said, either you get up and play with your teammates or get off the bench. And being ever vigilant as you are, saw that the kid got up and he walked out the near doorway. And after the game that we lost, all you wanted to talk about was why the kid, removed himself. And I didn't want to talk about it. And I didn't think it was your business or anybody's business. So on Sunday, the next day, the story wasn't about the championship game. It was about this kid walking off the bench, and they had a postage size photo of him. And I was so mad at you that I stopped calling in scores for
right.
December, and then till your sports editor Dan Payne straightened it out. Since then, we've made nice with each other, and I certainly respect you and your craft, and I read you all the time.
Well, I appreciate you, and obviously your family and the history and, you know, your dad's, you know, reputation preceded you, but like my experience with you was like you were a guy that it was evident you cared about kids. It was evident that you loved basketball. You wanted your kids to play the right way. And I still marvel at how hard your kids played and how disciplined they were and how smart your kids were playing. Like, how did you get kids to respond that way?
Well, again, almost everything that I know about about basketball comes from my father. And one of the many lessons I learned from him was that you wanted to treat the players that didn't get much playing time. Usually most teams have a rotation of eight. And so all the non-playing players, give them as much, if not more, attention in practice. Show them their value. And they were, for us, that was the white team. The Reds were the top eight, and the whites were, we would carry between 15 and 19 players.
Yeah.
And so the whites, and I would, and I coached them in many ways harder than I coached the Reds, but I think they appreciated that, and they made, you know, they had as much to do with our success as anything. When my father was at Cal, they had freshman basketball, they had varsity basketball, and they had a JV team that they called the Blues. And the Blues ended up, they were sophomores and juniors that weren't quite good enough to make the varsity. And they had it in the schedule. They played mostly JC teams in the area. And my father would every Wednesday during league, he'd send the regulars home, the varsity home, and then the last seven or eight on the varsity would scrimmage the Blues. And he coached the Blues in the scrimmage. And then many of those players went on to become starters a year or two later. So it was sort of like a feeder system. And for me, the lesson I learned that when we got into the league, every Wednesday, the non-playing players of the varsity would scrimmage the JV players. And, of course, it was very competitive, and the JV kids had given grief to the non-playing, oh, you're not very good. You know, if you were good, you'd be playing. And then we'd go out invariably and do very well against the JVs, and it gave them a healthy respect and realized that they better start working harder and improving their game if they wanted to get playing time, if they were going to move up.
The story goes that, you know, even when you carried a team of like 15 or 19, one of the goals that you had as a team was to win a game in which every player scored. What was that
Absolutely.
About?
Well, that was why not? Whoever scored the last basket was probably more thrilled about it than whoever scored the first basket, because they were used to it. And in the time that I was at Santa Cruz, we had four occasions in which we had that happen. And, gosh, I mean, so everybody in the locker room after the game could really feel a part of the victory because they all scored. And I've had kids over the years talk about that aspect. Some of the kids that talked about that aspect were regulars, and some of the kids were the two or three fellas that scored the last two or three baskets. Why not? And part of that is I just sort of have a bone to pick with Gottlieb, the coach at USC, who has let a very, very great young person, a basketball player, Juju Watkins, and she's left her in SC games in the fourth quarter when they've been up 45, 47 points. And they suit up 12, and there's some players that don't even get in at that time. And to me, that's not right. And I'll speak up against it if it ever does happen. In fact, this happened twice, and about a week ago in L.A., there was a team that won, I think it was L.A., but there's a high school team that won 105-6 or something, and the best player or the highest score for the winning team scored 92. I actually saw the youngest Ball score 90. No, actually, this kid got 100, but I saw Ball score 92 in a very competitive game. So, scoring basket, it would be like you legging out an infield hit. You know, I know you can hit the ball, but, you know, you didn't get many infield rollers where you beat the throw to first base.
I love it. Pete Newell Jr. is with us. I want to back up. What was it like to grow up in your household? You've got Tom and Roger and you and your mom in the room. Obviously, Florence Newell, big impact on your life. And you've got a dad who's coaching an Olympic basketball team and winning a national championship. What was life like in the Newell household?
During the season, especially as I got away when he's at Cal, I wasn't really that much aware of it when he's at Michigan State. I was ages 6 to 10. And prior to that, when he's at USF, I was younger than that, really not aware of it. But as I got older, his last year coaching, I was a sophomore in high school. And particularly the last 2 years, during the season, my father would start at 6'1", three quarter, weighing about 165, and with coffee and cigarettes, he'd get down to about 145. And I just realized, he put everything into it. We'd have dinner at the same time during the season, during the week, because I went to high school over in San Francisco. We lived in East Bay. And he wouldn't finish his dinner, and I loved it because I had two helpings of dinner literally every night. And my father would be lost in thought. And so that everything revolved around dad in the sense that if you could tell if he wanted to communicate, you could also tell if he didn't want to. And if he didn't want to, you gave him a wide berth. As with most families of the era, our family was run by my mother. And she was the main disciplinarian. She spent more time with the kids because her husband was, sort of like the breadwinner of the family. So we got along with dad great because he didn't discipline as much as she did.
Right.
And we're four boys. You mentioned two of my brothers. Yeah. I have a younger brother that's born in 56, Greg. So,
yes.
But as we left the house and went on to college or wherever, then the true value of mom, her unconditional love and teachings, but also the discipline that she gave us has held to this day of our respect for her.
Pete Newell Jr. is our guest. Pete, the relationship between Bobby Knight and your father, your dad was a mentor to him. Your mom was also on the phone often, as I recall, with Bobby, counseling him on a matter of issues. How much do you remember Knight being around, or how did that relationship blossom?
Well, the relationship began in 19, 67 or 68. I almost want to say 68. It was Knight's first year at Army as the head coach. And Stu Inman, who was my college coach at San Jose State, was now working for, at the time, for Converse before he went with the Trailblazers as the GM. And Stu knew Bobby, and he obviously knew my father. And he hooked those two men up in San Francisco. USF was having a two-day 14 tournament. Army was in it. So they met at the hotel where Army was staying in the afternoon, and Bobby and Dad were talking maybe about 2 hours just about basketball. They went to see the game, and the best official in the Bay Area for over 20 years was a man by the name of Ernie Filiberti, who had called Final Four games, championship games. And Filiberti was really a good official on his call and no calls, but he wouldn't take any grub from any ref or any coach. And Knight, of course, if he was displeased, you'd know it. And Ernie made a call that the Knight disagreed with, and he said something, including a four-letter word. And so Ernie teed him up this mid-first half. And before that whole episode was up, Knight had kicked over seven chairs, and he had gotten eight technical fouls. And so after the game that Army lost, he met with, because they said, let's get together after the game, he met with my father, and again, they talked the game, and they talked about Knight's reaction. And of course, Dad knew Filiberti, and he respected Filiberti. He didn't know Knight, so he respected Filiberti more than Knight. And I think that because of the way my father was literally brutally honest with Bobby early on, that began a relationship that lasted until my father passed in 2008.
Pete Newell Jr. is our guest. The 1960 Olympic team, that Jerry Lucas, Oscar Robertson, I mean, you think about the talent on that team. What do you remember of that?
Well, I was fortunate. I was between my sophomore and junior year in high school, and my father took me back to West Point where they trained. So I was around that team for 2.5 weeks and got to know all those players. The team, do you mind if I tell a story from the
trials?
No,
tell it. No, do it.
So my father had announced in 1960, they won the NCAA in 59. In 1960, with about 3 weeks to go in the regular season, he announced that he was going to retire from coaching at age 44, partly because, or a lot because of his health. And they happened to play the Final Four at the Cal Palace in San Francisco. Mm. They beat Cincinnati on Friday night, as they did the year before. Then Saturday night, they played this upstart team, Ohio State. And it was interesting because the previous summer, my father had been in Minnesota for 5 days doing a camp for coaches and players, and he had a college coach come to him the first day and say, "Coach, I've got this group coming in, but you know, I don't really know how to teach defense, and I'm a good offensive coach, and they don't play defense. And could you help me?" And Dad said, "Sure." So the next 4 nights, they were together 4 hours a night, just going over everything that my father knew about defense. Well, that coach turned out to be Fred Taylor, who was the Ohio State coach, and all of a sudden they're playing Cal for the NCAA championship, and on that Ohio State team was Jerry Lucas and John Havlicek. Larry Siegfried went on to play with the Celtics, was a pro as well. And they beat Cal by 20, and so that was it. My father's career was over. However, it was an Olympic year, and the Olympic committee, basketball committee, had decided that whoever coached the runner-up would be the coach of the NCAA All-Stars. And my father on that Sunday, he was over it. And unbeknownst to me, really, until a while later, my mother literally spent 5, 6, 7 hours all day talking to my father quietly about, you know, you've got to fulfill this, it's your responsibility, et cetera, et cetera. So the early evening he called and committed to coaching. Flies into Denver Tuesday. Wednesday they've got their first practice. Now they're going to play Thursday through Saturday. And they win Thursday, they win Friday. On that team, he had Oscar and he had Terry. Terry Dischinger, who had a wonderful pro career with the Portland Trail Blazers and longtime Dennis, with his son eventually taking the business in Lake Oswego. And Terry was the youngest of the team. He was only 19, just finished his sophomore year at Purdue. So Saturday morning, they're in the hotel dining room having breakfast, and a local guy had written a column about the upcoming game that night. And the best team considered in the tournament was the Phillips 66 Oilers. And AAU was an alternative for a lot of college players who graduated, didn't think they were good enough for the NBA. They could go work for the Oilers, have a year-round job, and be basketball mainly when the season was. So this writer said, and used quotes from the Oilers that they were not very impressed with the All-Stars, and, you know, they're only like 20, 21, and, you know, our team is, you know, 27 to 30. So the players read it very serious. They passed around a couple newspapers. Wes got up. He left. He walked out. And then Dad walked out to go have a cigarette. And he's walking down the street in Denver. And he stops and he looks across the street. And there in an alcove is Wes. And he's talking to a mannequin. And my father is watching. And he's watching for a couple minutes. And he's just carrying on, literally. It's a one-sided conversation. Nodding his head, using his arms in conversation with this mannequin. So Dad walks across the street. He goes, "Jerry," and he sort of came out of his, where his head was. He said, "Oh, Pete." And Dad said, "What are you doing?" And he goes, "Pete, I'm just sick." And Dad had known at the time that Wes' older brother, this is 1960, but 1952, Wes' older brother had died in the Korean War. And so he goes to my father, he says, "You know, I lost my brother in the Korean War, and my whole life, I don't know if that was true, but I've always wanted to represent our country in honor of him. And I played the two worst games that I've ever played in my life. On Thursday I had 4 points, and last night I had 6, and there's no way I'm going to make the Olympic team, and I'm just sick." And Dad said, "Well, you don't understand. They have a formula that whichever team wins tonight, their starting five automatically goes." And Wes looked at him, and it's like a 1,000-pound, you know, elephant came off his shoulders. And he said, "Oh, thank you for telling me." So in the locker room before the game, Dad went up to Oscar, and he said, "Oscar, I want you to look for Jerry a little bit more in the first half." And, of course, the whole team was incentivized by the article. And Wes had 27 in the first half. Wow. And they were up like over 20, and they ended up winning the game real easy. So you have that background. Now we push it forward to the 1st of August, and my father had these 12 players, but it was a heavy AAU committee, and 5 of the 12 were centers. And there were a couple of AAU guys that had no business being in the team. In fact, 2 people that my father wanted that had played in this tournament on other teams, and they turned them down. One was Havlicek, and another was Lenny Wilkins, and both of them obviously in the Basketball Hall of Fame. So Dad said to the team that when they first met, he said, "It's the 1st of August. We leave the United States on August the 15th. Our first game is the 22nd. We're playing with a ball that is not a regulation a basketball that you're used to. It's between the size of a basketball, men's ball and soccer ball. It has the markings of a soccer ball." So you think of a basketball and how the seams are to shoot it. Try to shoot a soccer ball with those markings. And then he said, you're not in shape. You've never played together, plus the Olympic rules. And we've never lost an Olympic basketball game, and I'm not going to be known as the first coach ever to lose one. So for the next 5 or 6 days, he had 3 3-hour practices a day. And believe it or not, the first game they played was against the ABL champions, the Cleveland Pipers, and in Canton, Ohio. And Cleveland beat them. And that got their attention, and they played the Pipers a few days later in Morgantown, West Virginia, and they beat them. But the point of all that was that those players became very selfless, and they knew that they weren't going to get their accustomed, especially Weston Robinson, and averaged 20-plus a game, and they were fine with that. They just were all in the team, and they just – winning the gold medal was the big thing for them, and they did. They were, I think the average margin of victory was like 46 points.
Pete Newell Jr. is our guest. We're going to take a quick break, Coach. And after the break, I want to ask you about your dad's rivalry with John Wooden. And I want you to maybe critique what you see happening in high school and college ball today. So stick around. More with Pete Newell Jr. after the break.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Our guest is Pete Newell Jr., the son of Pete Newell, who won an Olympic championship and a national championship at Cal and with the United States Olympic team. And Pete Newell Jr. coached for 30 years high school basketball in the state of California. He's telling stories and dishing wisdom on today's show. Hey, before I get into Wooden and your dad and what you see in basketball, tell me about the guard and the forward positions. You texted me something about this the other day, how they got their names, why they play where they play. What's the story behind guards and forwards?
Okay, so the identification of basketball positions probably started 100 years ago in the 1920s. And guards were so named because they guarded the basket. Forwards were so named because they were sort of the front line of defense and would pick up near half court. And then centers, you know, would man the lane, at least to start. So in man defense, it was felt for a long time in the first half of the 1900s, that forwards could not run baseline to baseline from offense to defense. And so regardless of where the shot went up, it was felt commonly that guards were faster getting back down the court, the smaller guys. So they're the ones that ran back to the rim, and then they would pick up the other team's forwards. And then, so that's, say, like Team A. So Team A shoots and misses. The guards run back to protect the rim. Team B's forwards come down the court, and the Team B's guards are playing where they normally play now, at least starting out near half court. So my father started coaching at USF right after the war, 46-47. He was hired by his college coach, who, by the way, was the first Olympic basketball coach himself during the Jesse Owens Olympics. His name was Jimmy Needles. And so the second year dad was there, 47-48, and they're playing a back-to-back Friday-Saturday night games against USC, coached by a Hall of Fame coach named Sam Berry. Sam Berry is in the Naismith Hall of Fame. He's College Baseball Hall of Fame. He also coached in SC, the national championship in the late 40s. He also coached football 1 year at SC. So they play, and SC had a guard that was 6'3". And he was a junior at that time, and he was really good. He went on to be an All-American. And my father decided that he wanted to pick up in the back court and have like a full court press. But that meant that he'd have to press with his forwards in the back court. He had 6'6", 6'8", forwards, and his guards were 5'4", and 5'9". And they're back protecting, you know, their the basket. Well, this 6'3 guy, they couldn't press him. He just went right around the two big USF players, and all of a sudden now it's a 5-on-3 because the two big guys are left behind him. And USF got killed by about 25. So the story goes that the next morning he had a shoot-around, and he told his players, he says, all right, we're going to pick up, but instead of guarding Bennington and McNamee, instead of you picking up their best player, 6'3", we're going to have Rennie and Frankie, 5'4 and 5'9", you're going to pick them up in the backcourt. And it was the first time ever that players started playing defense the way they play defense now, if you're going to full court press. Wow. And this 6'3 guy was not used to playing, bringing the ball up against small guys. He was always used to bringing the ball up against big guys. So he turned it over, and long story short, USF upset him. And then later that season, they went back to Madison Square Garden to play a couple games. Nobody back in New York had ever seen that kind of defense. A year later, when they went back to play in the NIT, he said that he was told, because they'd all meet at Tush Shores after the game, Dad was told that all the college teams back there in the New York area were running that kind of a defense. And by the way, the USC player that had trouble going against the smaller USF guards was Bill Sharman.
You know what? The modern game today, the art of screening, cutting away from the ball, passing to the cutter. Now when I watch a game, it's a bunch of guys spreading out, passing the ball, looking for a three-point shot. How disgusted are you watching basketball today?
Pretty disgusted. It's a cookie-cutter game from the pros to college to the high schools to AAU. And it's unfortunate because the game is about movement. It's about athleticism, certainly. And nowadays, more often than not, and more with the guards, they just yo-yo the dribble. And you may get lucky to have three passes a possession. Rarely do they swing the ball and attack the weak side defense. And and it's all in the name of analytics. And then they'll play four out or five out. And the fours and fives now will shoot threes. I was told a few days ago that last week in a pro game, there were 76 three-point shots. Why would anybody want to go watch two basketball teams shoot 76 three-pointers?
No, thank you.
And like you mentioned earlier, the movement away from the ball, the passing, the cutting, the screening, the subtlety of sets or offenses getting shots is gone now. And, you know, you mentioned it before I came on, that there's an Oregon high school coach that still runs reverse, and God bless him. But if you had a conversation about him, why he runs reverse, he would tell you that and by the way, my father learned reverse from Jimmy Needles at Loyola in the 30s, but reverse action has great spacing. And I'm not against three-point shooting, but I don't think it, you know, most teams now, that it's outside-outside attack. Where's the inside-outside attack? One of the better teams and different teams offensively in the country this year is Michigan State. And the men, they're not very good shooting the three, about 25%, usually it's 35 to 40% on average, but they defend well, they defensive rebound, and they sprint. And the cookie cutter is, oh, you're going to transition, you're going to run your two runners to the corner. They don't sprint to the corner. And how many times in transition, the pass go to the corner, somebody shoot it? Rarely. And so that's why they don't sprint to the corner as opposed to sprinting to the rim. So, but, and then the top number one women's team in the country is UCLA, and they sprint to the rim. And so does USC. I just watched them play Iowa a couple nights ago, even with Juju Watkins and all. They want to shoot layups. And unfortunately, nowadays, these kids want to go to the corner because their coaches tell them, but they don't really get much production from that kind of style.
I have just a few minutes left. I'd love to touch on your dad, Pete Newell, against John Wooden. How intense was that rivalry?
Very intense. And these were two highly competitive men who just, they didn't believe in timeouts. And as a result, neither ever, when they played each other, called a timeout in the first half. And the rivalry changed dramatically in 1958, when they 2 weeks ago in the season, and Cal and UCLA are playing Friday, Saturday at Cal, Friday, and there's a half game between them. UCLA wins Friday night, and Cal wins Saturday, and there's a story that I won't get into about why that happened, and then my father beat Coach Wooden the last eight times that they played each other, 58 through 60. Having said that, I do want to point out there was a great LA Times sports writer by the name of Jim Murray, yeah, that I'm sure you know about. And he wrote a column for 30-plus years for the Times. And he, towards the end, his eyesight failed him a lot, but he still did the column. And my mother died in 1984, and a couple of weeks passed, and Dad's getting all this mail, and he got a note from Jim Murray, who had known a long time. And Murray had lost his wife about eight to nine months before, and he told, in the letter, he told Dad, he said, a way to help grieve is all these letters that you're getting from people. You want to respond to them, and maybe think of a time that you and Florence and this person or that couple, the four of you were together socially or whatever, and just bring that up and thank them, et cetera, et cetera. So Dad did that, and it took him about 8 months to complete that letter-writing campaign. But he said by the time he finished that, he had done all the grieving. A lot of times in those days, he would cry uncontrollably at his loss. Well, in the early 90s, Coach Wooden lost his beloved wife, Nell. And Wooden and my father hadn't really talked for a long time, and it was still an icy relationship when they saw each other. But Dad wrote the same kind of letter to Coach Wooden that Jim Murray had written to him, and Coach Wooden did what Dad did. He wrote letters to people that had written him, but it really thawed the relationship between the two men. And that was really cool to see, because you couldn't have asked for two bitter rivals amongst coaches as you could between those two people. But they healed it. And,
yeah,
the last 15 years they had a great relationship.
I love that they wouldn't call timeout. Like, so it was like a badge of honor that they were not calling timeout. Like, let's see who calls
absolutely
the first timeout.
Who is better conditioned? In fact, in the late 50s, I want to say starting in 58, the last 3 years, there was a hill behind the Cal football stadium that went a mile straight up. And they, every year my dad was there, he coached at Cal for 6 years, they would do like cross country, but they'd run that hill. And that 58 season, their pacer was a guy by the name of Don Bowden, who was the first American ever to run a sub-4-minute mile while he was at Cal. And so, and I would see pictures of these guys at the bottom of the hill. They had already run like 3 miles before they got to the bottom of the hill. So that was the incentive, was that we want to be in better condition than UCLA.
All right. Before you go, advice for youth basketball coaches, coaches in general, high school coaches. You get a couple minutes to talk to coaches. What advice do you give to them about, you know, what you see today and what needs to be done?
Well, I think that first and foremost, they need to be teachers. They to teach fundamentals, keep the fun in fundamentals. A lot of their limitations for coaches is that they don't have the time. You know, maybe they only have an hour practice or whatever. But part method teaching, as a one-on-one or two-on-two or one-on-oh, two-on-oh, is much better than five-on-oh. That's not part method, or five-on-five. And I also feel, you know, one of the points that my father made forever was that the quality of your shot is dependent on the quality of your footwork. And I don't really think that the coaches at all levels, both genders, spend a lot of time with teaching the game, and footwork is an important cornerstone of that teaching, especially offensively. And then the other thing is that, you know, just keep encouraging them because they are going to make mistakes, and that if they are, as all kids will, they're going to struggle. But gosh, you know this from baseball, that I mean, you can hit 300, but that means you failed 7 out of 10 times.
Right.
And so learn how to compete within yourself, but just to pick yourself up when your shot's not going. If you're a 4-for-10 shooter, 40%, and you've missed your first 6 shots, believe you're going to hit the next 4 as opposed to say, oh, this is my day, I'm going to miss 10. And then the last thing I would say about young coaches is that find out through observance who the better teachers are at your high school level, your college level, and learn from them. Matt Painter at Purdue is a wonderful teacher. Jay Wright, before he left Villanova, is a wonderful teacher. Tony Bennett at Virginia was a wonderful teacher. And I'm sure that in the greater Portland area, there are wonderful teachers. And I guess probably the epilogue to all this is learn the history of the game. You want to be a caretaker of the game, and you can't be a caretaker of the game if you don't know the history of it.
Amen. Pete Newell, Jr., thank you. I appreciate you coming on.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. There he goes. A lot of history, a lot of wisdom. I hope coaches heard some of that. I love the storytelling. My phone was blowing up from people who say, I know this era. I know these coaches. That's the kind of interview I think that you know, you could share with people who know basketball, who know that era of basketball in particular. We are going to pivot to the NFL in Hour 3. It's coming up. Anna will have the 5 at 5 as well. Leave it here. You got the BFT.